right. Welcome back to another episode of Safari Stories. This is a bit of a strange one, or it's a different version of what we've been doing in the past, in the sense that I am sitting by myself in a car, in my car, in the Kruger National Park at a campsite, and this is going to be the first podcast that you hear from Safari Stories that it's just one person, which is me. So it might be a bit cringy, but let's see how it goes. I suppose it's the same as just leaving a very long voice note on WhatsApp to someone and telling them about what you've been seeing while out on safari. I'm going to backtrack a little bit. I'm going to go back to last week. And this is going to be a bit more of a current podcast in the sense that I'm just going to talk a little bit about what I've been doing over the last week and why I've enjoyed some of the things that I've been doing so much, and I hope it's interesting. Last week I went up to a place called Makuya Game Reserve, which is a community-owned and run game reserve that borders the Kruger National Park in the far northern part of the Kruger. So it actually borders the Makuleke or Pufuri concession of Kruger Park, which I talk about all the time, and I feel like on most of the last few episodes I've talked about it with people like Mike, Hein, Snurse, and also with Hadley. And this Makuya area, it's about 15,000 hectares. It's very narrow. It is... most of it is actually river frontage, and then there's maybe a couple of kilometers that are away from the river, but it's along the Luvubu River, and the Luvubu River is sort of forms the southern boundary of the Makuleke concession, and then also part of the western boundary, and I was just totally blown away by it, by the whole experience, because it's very unique for South Africa. It's sort of reminded me a little bit of Mana Pools in Zimbabwe, which is a unique camping experience in itself, in that you are in an area that is totally unfenced, and that's not that unique, but you're allowed to walk in Mana Pools, and you're also allowed to walk in Makuya Game Reserve. Well, I'm pretty sure you're allowed to walk. We walked anyway, and it was an absolute blast. There was just four guys, four of us who went, a bit of a lad's trip. And it's a bit of a drive, and the roads aren't great getting there, at least in the last bit. But when you get to this campsite where we were there for 3 nights, it just really blew us away. It's under these massive riverine trees like jackalberries and niala berries, these really big, tall trees. And we just parked the cars there. It's a very, very basic campsite. There's only a tap and a very basic ablutions block. If you want hot water and a shower, then you have to start a fire under what's called a donkey boiler. So it's essentially like a very basic boiler that keeps water flowing through it, and that water gets heated up by a wood fire that you put underneath it, sort of like in the olden days, I suppose. And so the campsite itself was very basic but beautiful in its setting, because it's right on the Luvubu River as well. So for 3 days we explored this Makuya area. You're also allowed to fish, and one of the guys actually managed to pull out a tiger fish, which is a fish that is hard to land, put it that way, and there was only one fish landed over the course of 3 days, and it was this tiger fish. Lots of bites, the tiger fish that he caught was this beautiful fish, and we caught and released it. Of course, you put it back into the, threw it back into the river. But where he caught it as well, the setting was just incredible. It was underneath these cliffs called the Musundu Cliffs, I believe, and you just walk into the riverbed, and there's this just massive sheer cliff face of probably 150 feet or so. Directly in front of you on this river, and as we got there was this big male hippo in the river, and he just kind of moved upstream a little bit, and then he was watching us fish for the majority of the day. Wouldn't have disturbed him too much, because hippos don't do much during the day. They just generally spend the day in the water, and they sleep for most of the day, and he was just kind of eyeing us up, and he relaxed after a very short while, and just was quite happy with us fishing there. At least it seemed to me like he was fairly happy. There was also a crocodile in the water that moved off, so when you're fishing in an area like that, you need to be very aware of the fact that there are crocodiles, and you just need to make sure that you don't get super close to the water's edge. What I loved about Makuya wasn't necessarily the fact that you could just do what you wanted, in the sense that you could walk wherever you wanted, and that you could fish, or that you could pretty much, you couldn't drive wherever you wanted, but that you could explore this whole new area. It was the fact that you could do all of these things by yourself. And what I mean by that is there was not one other person that we saw in the 3 days that we were there. And that is something I find to be quite unique. And it's South Africa is a country that is pretty well traversed and has a very good infrastructure tourism-wise. So it's quite rare, I would say, to come across an area like that, to come across a reserve that you can really explore completely by yourself. We didn't see a huge amount of wildlife. We saw a lot of wildlife. We didn't see a huge amount of mammal species. We saw elephants a couple of times. We saw lots of signs of leopard, lion. We heard hyena at night, and we saw brilliant bird life. It's up in the northern part of Kruger, as I mentioned, and that area has spectacular birds, as you might have you might remember from previous podcasts. I rave about it all the time. But the fact that we were able to kind of get up also and either go on foot or go by vehicle, and it became very evident to us very quickly that there was no one else on the entire reserve. The fact that we were able to do that just gave us this sense of freedom, and then also the sense of true wilderness. And I feel like I sometimes just rant about how wilderness is disappearing and dying, and how it's very difficult to come by this, by wilderness. But you really got that sense. And the lovely thing about it as well is we weren't paying an arm and a leg to be there. I think it cost sort of 150 rand, so just over $10 per person a night to stay there for this very authentically wild experience. And I know a company that actually runs primitive trails there. So they go into Makuya and they then walk, I'm assuming, mostly along the river, because it's definitely the most action-packed part of the reserve. And they do these primitive wilderness trails there because it is truly wild. So that was Makuya. After Makuya, so that was last week. After Makuya, I went back to my friend Sarah's, where we recorded the first podcast of this series. And Sarah and I, Snurse and I, went on a mission to find a very rare bird called a Pell's fishing owl, which we've also probably chatted about previously. But it's this very large ginger owl that lives in these unique river systems that have these sort of very slow moving waters and big trees on the sides, kind of like the Luvuvu. Actually, on the Luvuvu, you do find them a bit. But at Snurse's, we're on the Olifants River, and we went looking for this owl. And it's just close to this part of the Olifants River where the river actually falls by about, I'd say, about 100 feet or so. And it's a very, very large river. It's not totally full at the moment because we're in the dry season. But it's this very large river, and where it falls, it's just magnificent because of the geological formations that it makes. It causes these huge potholes to form. And the noise that you can hear these falls from Snurse's house, which is about 3, maybe 4 miles away. So the sound of the water travels really far. And that's also just an auditory experience that I find that when you're not in an area like that, that's extremely quiet, you don't really get too much of. So just having these falls roaring nearby while we were looking for the Pell's fishing owl was unbelievable. So we've actually found it a few weeks ago when Hadley was still with me in South Africa. This time around, Snurse and I didn't find it, but we did find a very large primary feather, so a big wing feather that I'll show you a picture of. The experience itself of just walking along this stream very quietly, both of us very concentrated, kind of looking up into the trees, but also just enjoying the other things that we were seeing. Like, we had a hooded vulture, which is an endangered vulture species that flew over us and is also a good indicator that the environment or the habitat is in good health. And just small indicators like the feather as well were enough for us to just have this very, very nice time together. And I'm flying home tomorrow. And it's just really nice to have spent the last afternoon with Snurse exploring in that way. After being with Snurse, I traveled down to Hein in White River, where we recorded the most recent podcast. And I spent a morning birding with both Hein and a guy called Duncan McKenzie, who I'm hoping in the future will also be a podcast guest. He didn't seem like he had time this time, but he is an ecologist who spends his livelihood is gained by doing ecological assessments, where he goes to all sorts of different countries and places in Africa. He does a survey of what species are found in that area, whether it's for a mining company or for the government who want to build a highway somewhere, and then he tells them why they should or shouldn't build it here because there are certain endangered species, and whether it's a bird, a mammal, or a plant, it's all very relevant. But obviously certain species are more important in that sense than others because they're more threatened. And then he gives a report to the company or the government saying, this is why you should or you should not build here. So I'm really hoping that he comes on the podcast. He's an absolutely incredible birder. So where I met him was at eco training when I did my advanced birding course, and he was the instructor. And I was just blown away by his enthusiasm for birds and for everything living, pretty much. And he really unlocked a sense of wildlife to me that I've never experienced before, just because of how enthusiastic he is about the bush and everything to do with it. So we went out this morning, actually that's earlier this morning, for this little mini birding mission in Nelspruit, so in quite a large town. And we left town, and within like 3 minutes or so, we got to this low water bridge. And we parked the cars just in front of the bridge, and Duncan's son, Nathan, who's, I think he's about 10 years old, he came with us as well. And he actually saw a new mammal species for himself. For us, the other three, it wasn't a new mammal, but it was also phenomenal, because when we got down to the low water bridge, Hein pointed at the water and said, oh, there's a finfoot, which is this really rare or hard to see bird. And then he looked again through his binos. He said, no, it's not a finfoot. It's an otter, actually. So you get two species of otter in southern Africa. One is called a Cape clawless otter, and the other is a spotted necked otter. And in Nelspruit, or in this part of South Africa, you only get the Cape clawless. It's a much larger otter and looks very similar, I suppose, to most of the kind of sea otters, or in Europe, like the riverine otters and sea otters that you're used to. And they've got this lovely white bib across their front. And there was one otter that was swimming upstream, kind of away from us, and then we saw another otter that was actually out of the water on a rock right beside the bridge, so it was maybe 50 feet or so away from us. And yeah, it just walked along this rock a little bit, looked up at us, stayed put for a few seconds, and then kind of walked off into the reeds. And it wasn't nervous, or it wasn't afraid of us, probably because it is living in a fairly densely populated place, so it's used to seeing people. But that really kick-started the morning, because after that, it just seemed everything was right. Everything that we were seeing was just brilliant and amazing. And that is how sort of experiences when you're out here go sometimes. You just get in the right mindset, and then anything and everything that comes your way is just brilliant. Because as soon as this otter disappeared, we were all elated, of course. And then Duncan said, this is a great place also. And Duncan is a Nelspruit local, so he really knows this area very well. And he'd never seen otter there, so that got him excited as well. But he said, now this is a really good place to see a bird called a half-collared kingfisher. And I'll try and ask Duncan for his photos, because he managed to get a few photos of these kingfishers that then just appeared on a branch close to where the otter had been, and were sort of posing and almost dancing. And we're not quite sure what this dance represented. And again, Duncan, who's an extremely well-informed birder, didn't really know what this bird dance indicated. It could have been some kind of a mating ritual or pre-mating ritual, but it's not really the right time of year. Though that being said, a lot of what's going on here has been thrown out of whack by the high amount of rainfall that occurred earlier on this year. And the rainfall also went on until, I think, early May, maybe even until later in May, which is quite unusual. So a lot of bird species are thrown out of whack by that. The water table is much higher, so a lot of tree species are actually flowering a lot sooner because of that as well. But anyway, so we saw this half-collared kingfisher, and these two half-collared kingfishers that were dancing around, and in the morning light, the color of them is just ridiculous. It's this, just like a, I suppose, like a normal kingfisher that you would picture in your head, but the blue is much darker and more brilliant, which I don't know if that makes any sense, but anyway, we'll try and get Duncan's photo if he's obliging. He might let me use it. After that, we went and just birded along a farm. So we got access into this citrus farm. A lot of this Nelspruit area of South Africa is largely citrus farming and also macadamia farming. And we went onto this citrus farm and birded along this dam. And what was really cool was that both Hein and I managed to see a bird that we've never seen before in Southern Africa. So amongst birders, birders have lists for different regions that they find birds in. And Southern Africa is Africa below the Zambezi. So that includes Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, south of the Zambezi, and South Africa, and Eswatini and Lesotho as well. But Hein and I both saw a new bird, which Duncan pointed out to us. It's called a brown-backed honeybird. And it's called honeybird because it's just like a honey guide or even a honey badger. It's traditionally seen to lead people to where beehives are so that they can harvest honey, and then the bird also is able to get some of the honey. But how he picked it out was just insane, because he said, no, there's a honeybird calling. And he said it's this loud, high-pitched trill, this drrr. And I thought, I can't hear anything. Like, I've no idea what he's talking about. But then the birds flew in our direction and were trilling a bit louder. And then we eventually were able to see them, and they were flying high up in the sky. And I looked through the binos and I could see them, but I couldn't really, like, it could have been any bird basically. And I don't really want to tick a bird off my list until I can identify it as well. So not just see it, but also positively identify it. And then luckily later on we were driving and the same bird, or the same species rather, came and perched on the side of the road for us, and we also managed to get a photo of it, or Duncan also managed to get a photo of it then. So that was a really magnificent morning. I'm coming to the end of a month-long trip in South Africa now, and it's been really, really great. And I'm trying to piece together why I think it's always such a pleasure to be here for me. And I've lived here, I've spent many years in Southern Africa and in Africa, obviously. And I'm trying to, again, put my finger on why I really enjoy it so much. And I think what I've come up with is that, you know, you have to take from a trip to Africa what you want. And that needs to be at your level. And of course, there are people such as Duncan or even like Hein or whoever that can add to it by showing and explaining more to you. But really, you need to also figure out what you enjoy when you go. And for me personally, it's the fact that I used to probably understand a bit more about the bush than I do now, because I used to live in the bush full time. But when I spend a bit more time here, I start to understand a bit more about the ecosystem and the ecology. And it's just very, very small things that I'm able to piece together in my head. So it's something as small as, like, this tree is flowering now because of this. So like I mentioned, some of the trees, like the knobthorns, for example, they're flowering at the moment, and they do flower earlier than other tree species, but because they have quite deep roots that are able to tap into the water level earlier. But it's just something as small and simple as that I find absolutely incredible. And it just, I get so enthusiastic and emotional about it, because I really feel in that sense that I'm kind of quite grounded and connected to the planet. And that's something that I find that a lot of people, and I don't mean specific people, that I just mean in general, people who are living in a city, for example, are losing. It's this connection to wilderness and to the planet which we belong to. And I feel like that over the years we've managed to devolve and disconnect from the planet. Even in my lifetime, I feel like that I've personally disconnected from the planet in so many different ways, so that when I come back here and I spend a bit of time here and I start to feel a bit more grounded and connected to the planet again, it's a really it's really heartwarming, and it gives me hope. It gives me hope for us as people. I'm getting a little bit off track here, but it gives me hope that as people we really are able to find ourselves again and get back on track. So I think I'm going to just conclude this podcast, and whether this gets posted in this form or not, that's a different story. But I think I'm just going to conclude this as the last podcast from within South Africa, and maybe Hadley and I will talk a little bit more about Tswalu in another episode soon, and say that whatever you do, wherever you are, I think it's very important to go out and spend a little bit of time in whatever nature is available to you, so that you can also feel grounded again. And even if it's only a snippet of 5 minutes during the day, even if you're living in a big apartment block in New York City, which we did in May and June, and you can only get to Central Park, I say only because Central Park is amazing, do it, because even those 5 minutes, or even if it's an hour a day, or even just an hour a week, will make you really feel like you belong to the planet again. Maybe that sounds very cheesy, but I'm going to finish on that note, and I hope you enjoyed this episode. It was very, very different and very strange for me to do it, and yeah, see you guys again, hopefully with Hadley, next week.